Welcome to a Tuesday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast after the Golden State Warriors take Game 1 of the Western Conference Finals, 110-106, over the Houston Rockets. Danny and I were there for this game. Fantastic atmosphere at Oracle, probably the best of the playoffs that I've seen. I missed Game 2 against Memphis, but I'm guessing that wasn't too good.
Not great.
Yeah. What's up, Danny? How you doing?
That was a pretty fun game. I mean, it had so many ebbs and flows to it. I mean, it feels like such a long time ago that the Rockets had that really good first quarter.
Yeah, they did. And really, I thought what changed the game was when Bogut went out and they brought Lee in and then Azealia. That was really when the Rockets were able to build that lead, because at that point, they were able to get just about anything they wanted at the basket. The Warriors were going pretty well. Then when they took Howard out after he injured his knee, Kerr decided to steal some minutes with Lee, save Bogut for when Howard came back in, and then Houston was able to start driving to the basket. Maybe the Warriors let up a little bit with Howard going out of the game, and the Rockets were able to take a 31-24 lead after the first quarter. And really, the Warriors defense wasn't even that good, because the Rockets were only 4 out of 10 on free throws in that period.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And they were getting what they wanted, especially when David Lee was the rim protector, quote unquote. They didn't have any fear, so they were just going in, and whether they were getting a foul or whether they were getting the bucket, they were getting what they wanted, which I think was surprising that early, I guess.
Clint Capella had a nice game.
Yes, he did.
He was 4 out of 4 in 13 minutes. Did a nice job actually switching out on Curry. I think he forced 2 misses, then Curry hit that one awesome step back that was a tough 2 in his face to end the half. But he actually played pretty well. He was one of the few Rockets who had success finishing around the rim. A key in this game was the fact that the Rockets weren't that bad right at the rim in the restricted area. They're 20 of 31. But in the paint, 6 out of 20 in the paint outside of the restricted area. And that really hurt them a lot. Another thing, just from a shot distribution standpoint, the Warriors were able to shut down their three-point shooting. They only took 22 of those, which is well below their average. They like to get up 30 or more of those, ideally. And the Warriors were able to run them off the line pretty well.
Yeah, I thought the Warriors deserved a lot of credit for that. I mean, Ariza was making the ones he took, but they weren't taking it down. Harden was doing other things. You know, he was distributing early on, and then it was kind of incredible to see in person, because it was one of the few times that I've really gotten to see that kind of a Harden game, of when he was just getting these, you know, step backs and just drilling all of them. And they never took the lead during that stretch, but you could tell as a defense it had to be incredibly frustrating, because you felt like, you know, if you were on that team, if you're on the Warriors, you're sitting there going, okay, you know, we did a pretty good job for 18, 19 seconds. A couple times they blew it and got a late foul or whatever, but then a couple times he just hit a hard shot, and he deserves a ton of credit for being able to make those more reliably than almost anybody.
Yeah, I mean, that said, Harden, 20 field goal attempts, only 6 free throw attempts, so he only got fouled, only got 3 shooting fouls in the game. I think when you look at that ratio of 20 field goal attempts to 3 shooting fouls, you can definitely live with that if you're the Warriors. He also had 5 turnovers, yep, which is important. 4 steals, which is noteworthy. Efficient game for him, obviously. 28 points on 23 shooting possessions. As you noted, it took quite a bit from them. They also had a few kind of weird lapses on him, too. Like, yeah, Clay actually got beat backdoor a couple of times. And I think they'll take that, because they're denying him and making it hard on him. And he's not someone who normally goes hard backdoor, though he started realizing that he might be able to get that. But I think him going backdoor and them getting some help is something that they'll deal with if you can force him to work harder and make his catches tougher on some of the more normal plays.
Yeah, and something I wanted to talk about, you brought up Capella, who I was going to bring up, is that it, for me, it can be exciting when you see a guy and you're watching him contribute now, but I started thinking about, you know, what he could be in a couple of years once he gets a better sense of the offense. And I was a huge fan of him. I think I had him ludicrously high on his board. What I saw of him, I really liked. But his defensive potential is pretty exciting for a Rockets team that has had a lot of trouble finding a backup center.
Yeah, he's definitely good. I mean, he's young, he's inexperienced, obviously, but can certainly move his feet pretty well. I was I didn't like him as much having seen him in person a couple of times, and that's always kind of the danger of that, where I had him ranked a little higher than just my subjective in-person assessment. I saw him at the 2013 Euro Camp and then the 2014 Hoop Summit, and he didn't impress in either situation. He was really skinny, and I thought he was more kind of, you know, center skills and a power forward body, and I think he's always going to kind of be that way from a strength standpoint. Yeah, I mean, I think he's, especially as a backup center, he's able to do some things, and against a team like the Warriors that doesn't really post up or offensive rebound too much, he can be more effective. But one of the problems with him and really the Rockets in general is that they weren't able to quite get the level of communication that was needed on defense, and I think a lot of that, too, was the crowd, where they just weren't able to hear each other, maybe. The Warriors are able to do it with hand signals when the crowd gets loud, but you know, we saw Houston flub switches quite a few times, whether it was a switch or a help and recover situation. Maybe they didn't even know themselves, but they gave up a lot of easy backdoor system buckets, especially in the second half.
And that's, you brought up another good point during the game, which is something, you know, we talk about the impact of crowd noise more in terms of feel and things like that, but it's that it affects the way that a game is officiated, because what you're hearing on the court is different than what you hear in a quieter arena.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you, a lot of times it's real tough to tell when someone goes for a strip or goes for a block shot, whether there's actually contact on the arm or not. And if you hear a slap as a referee, sometimes, you know, maybe at 2-3 calls a game, that'll be your signal that you should call it. But, you know, if it's so loud you can't hear that, then, you know, maybe you're not going to make that call. And this was a game that I thought, that, you know, we talked a lot about what the foul situation was going to be in this series. I thought that the Rockets did get to the line 28 times, but it wasn't so much Harden. They also shot pretty poorly, 18 out of 28. Howard, I think, was, let me see what he was. Howard was 1 out of 4. You know, Smith is actually 3 out of 4, I shouldn't say that. Jones was 1 out of 4. So they struggled a bit more, and also, while there were a lot of fouls, the Draymond Green didn't get into foul trouble, and he was, of course, one of the Warriors' best performers tonight, playing center in that small lineup.
Yeah, and I feel like we have to get there. And what was really kind of intriguing about the small lineup that they put out there, they've done a two small kind of variants on it, and one of the things for me in this game, and I actually asked Steph Curry about after the game, is we've been seeing more of Sean Livingston, Stephen Curry, and Klay Thompson playing together. And the lineup that took the lead from 14, I believe, for the Rockets down to a 3-point Warriors lead at the end of the half had Livingston in, and I thought he was a huge part of what made that work.
Yeah, he was able to get it going in and really kind of kept them afloat during those sort of dire bench times when Azili and Lee were in at center in the first half, but he was able to get to the line on some somewhat iffy loose ball fouls, and then was able to hit a couple of tough J's too over Corey Brewer that at least kept it from, you know, really getting out of hand during that period. And then defensively and you know, with his activity, he was excellent once they went to that small lineup. And so how did that small lineup do overall? They were like plus 20 or something for the game, weren't they?
Yeah, I believe they were. I believe they were plus 17 in the first half, and they were plus 1. But you can argue that plus 1 has a little wiggle room, because the end of the game, the Rockets went on a little bit of a run. And I guess they did technically have a chance to tie it. But, you know, it was kind of one of those runs when the team might not have been pushing as hard as they could have. But, you know, still, I think it was plus 18 off the top of my head. But they played fabulously together. The other benefit, I've been an advocate for Livingston and Curry playing together for a long time, and part of it is that I'm somebody who loves having two really reliable ball handlers on the court. And in some ways, Livingston's role offensively is what they wanted Andre Iguodala to do, you know, when they signed him a couple years ago. And Livingston does that so much more intuitively because he was born and raised as a point guard. You know, he that is what he does. And so he can play on the ball and off the ball. Steph Curry is a wonderful off-ball player. And so you can use them, and that puts a lot less of the creation onus on Clay, though he did a really nice job in that second quarter of doing some things that I honestly had never seen from him.
Yeah, that's how we breed our point guards in Illinois, right? But born and raised as a point guard, John Livingston from
like Derrick Rose, man.
Good old Peoria, Illinois. I can't really claim that though. Peoria is not the same as Chicago. Everyone in Chicago and downstate's probably mad at me right now for saying that. But
for not fighting the California kid on my Illinois geography.
Well, yeah, I think the small lineup was enormous, and the biggest reason was that Houston just had no prayer stopping it, especially in that second quarter stretch, really in about 6 minutes. It was 49-35, and then at the end of that stretch, it was 58-55, Warriors with the lead, and they got pretty much any shot that they wanted during that period. They were 6 out of 7 at the rim during that six-minute stretch, and also 1 out of 5 on threes, but all 5 of those threes were pretty much wide open.
Yep.
So they really like got just about anything they wanted, and it wasn't quite as good in that second stretch, but still was pretty excellent. So Houston defensively is really going to be searching for answers to stop that unit.
And we saw them use that lineup both with and without Dwight Howard on the floor. Granted, that was a more limited Dwight because Josh Smith had already fallen into his knee. So it sounds like he's going to play in game two, but it definitely was not the same Dwight Howard. But they felt confident running, and there were a couple of those possessions. It's something that you see periodically, and it's when a team has a rim protector, but the rim protector is not back on that play. Sometimes that's even better to exploit it because I feel like teams think about it a little bit differently when they think they have a safety net or when they think they might have a safety net. And so the Warriors, sometimes they were just getting by and they're like, hey, there's no one here. Let's get a layup or, you know, move the ball around. And the other dynamic with those lineups is that everybody on the floor can move the ball so well. And we talk a lot about with this Warriors team, was something I criticized the Mark Jackson era so much for, is that these guys know the quality of shots that they can generate. And so particularly with that unit, I mean, you just saw them sometimes turning off on a good shot and getting something even better.
This series was in some ways offensively a little bit of an opposite, at least, well, I shouldn't say series, but this first game, because the Warriors had a lot more success against Memphis with Steph Curry on the ball running pick and rolls, especially when Zach Randolph was involved. Against Houston, the point guard defenders actually did okay on ball, Prigioni and Terry, but they got destroyed off ball, and a lot of Curry's shots were off ball, either when there was a switch, they had some success, the Warriors did, having Curry give up the ball and then come off screens with someone like Capella or Josh Smith guarding him, which Houston didn't have the communication to switch that again or really take care of that, or just, you know, going against Terry or Prigioni off the ball. That's where a lot of Draymond Green's assists came from. He had 8 assists, which is, you know, his passing from the power forward position is something that a lot of people don't talk about. Curry only had 5 assists himself and 0 secondary assists. So you can see Green's assists weren't necessarily coming out of pick and roll, which they often are, where they'll double team Steph and then they'll throw it to Green. A lot of it was him dribbling out top and then those guys coming off screens and shooting, or Green pushing the ball in transition. So that's another thing Houston's going to have to find a way to combat. Memphis was great at holding Steph and Clay off the ball, so they couldn't really get free. But that didn't work as well for Houston. So they're going to have to go back to the drawing board and find a way to guard Steph off the ball. Certainly their bigs did not rotate out the way they need to in an emergency situation. They got to be able to make the read when there's a down screen for Steph or Clay and see if their guy's caught. You just got to switch out and deal with it because you can't give up that wide open three. And their bigs did a horrible job of that in this game.
And there were two, I think it was late in the third quarter, might have been early in the fourth, Jason Terry had hit a kind of notable three to bring the Rockets closer, and I think he did a little talking after that. And then the next two times down, Curry got open off the ball and got wide open corner threes and drilled both of them. And that, I think that kind of swung the feeling back in the building. And again, that was an example of him being off the ball. Those weren't his, you know, dribble, do a crossover and pull up. Those were what kind of more like what in some ways what they would do sometimes with Jackson, is, you know, but his first, that earlier time with him is to, you know, do him off the ball, get him a nice screen and a good look. And Steph deserves a lot of credit for being able to hit those too. You know, he's maybe the best off the dribble 3-point shooter in the league, but he's an incredible spot up guy as well.
Yeah, he'll practice that before the game too, where he will, you know, he'll shoot his normal shot, and then he'll also practice just shooting absolutely as fast as he can. And that's how you get to be money at those shots, to have such a quick release, is he'll just literally shoot it absolutely as fast as he can. It's really just something that is unbelievable how quick he gets his shot off. One thing that happened here with that we had talked about in the previous podcast was they actually did go to the point guardless lineup.
Yay!
How did you feel that fared?
I thought it did all right. There were some moments. The challenging thing when you go to something that you haven't gone to very often is that while you have talented players, people are in different spots than they're usually in. And so I think that it's a lineup that had definitely had an adjustment. But I thought for the most part they did all right. How did you feel about it?
Yeah, I think that the concept is decent, although, you know, Terry was getting killed off the ball, as we said. I think what you would like to do if you're going at that lineup, especially since Howard was out at that time period, because he basically didn't play much beyond the first couple minutes of the fourth quarter, I guess both due to ineffectiveness and because his knee was bothering him, and maybe that's why he was ineffective. But I thought it did okay. They really should be switching everything with that lineup, especially if it's going against the green at center lineup. And they just didn't have the communication necessary to do that. There are a couple of plays. There's the play where Ariza and Green got tangled up. And that occurred when Green set a back screen for Curry. And Josh Smith guarding Green just completely didn't react to Steph Curry going backdoor wide open on that play, and then another one where Green also set a screen. I mean, when you see that your guy Trevor Ariza is guarding Curry, has fallen down, and Green has also fallen down, how do you not react to Steph Curry? I mean, he got just wide open layups under the basket because Josh Smith didn't react there. But yeah. I think if they can get better communication and maybe practice that a little bit more, it might be something that they can go to. But, you know, the Warriors have been playing that way all season and having a lot of success, and this off-ball movement by the Warriors, when you don't have guys like Allen and Mike Conley, like Memphis did, who can muck that up, it's very difficult to deal with.
Agreed. One thing I was thinking about in the time between when the game ended and when we're recording is, did this game make you feel more or less confident in how the Rockets are going to do in this series?
Less, because Howard's hurt.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think that at full strength, though, I thought they did a nice job. You know, that first quarter was better than they've played against the Warriors all year. You know, they've had well-documented struggles against them. But at the same time, we don't know. I mean, I always get scared with knee stuff. You know, it sounds like he's going to play in game two. But, you know, if he is anything less than 100%, that team is so much more beatable and specifically exploitable by the type of team that the Warriors are.
Yeah, I think it was described as a knee bruise, knee contusion, something along those lines. But I mean, you did, and you didn't see like too much of a buckle on the replay, so you would hope that it's not something that's going to be too debilitating. But he clearly was limited when he was out there afterwards, and over a 2-day period, you know, it's definitely the sort of thing that's going to swell up a little bit. So, you know, if we do see him in the next game, I think you're would probably be a good bet to expect that he's going to be a little bit limited again. And if that's the case, I mean, he had zero success posting up, just like in the regular season in this game, and had five turnovers, despite the fact that he didn't really take too many shots. So with Howard, especially being limited physically for someone who relies on his physicality, is a big problem. You know, if he's going to has to be fighting for post position. I mean, one play where he got that foul where he kind of elbowed Green a little bit, and, you know, that was a little bit of a flop. But what happened when you do that as a post player is when you're kind of pushing on the guy with your lower body and you can't move him and he's kind of leaning on you, and then you'll sort of try to elbow him, you get frustrated. And Dwight, whether it was the knee or just because Green is strong enough, wasn't able to push him back. And that's when you kind of get frustrated and you go to the elbow or the upper body, and he got called for it. So I think it's, you know, having that injury could be a major problem for him. Also, you know, with his mobility, trying to defend the pick and roll with Curry, it's definitely not good, and really a shame for Howard, someone who worked hard to get back from all the health problems that he had, and really had looked great in the playoffs up until now.
Yeah, and the other component of that is transition, because if you're playing 5-on-4, I guess you would say, you'd phrase it in terms of the offense, against the Warriors in transition, that's hard. You know, it and with the way that they attack so early in it, early in the shot clock, but early in the transition play, that's going to be even harder for him, because if he can't get all the way back, then there are going to be a lot of opportunities. Another thing I wanted to talk about, I hadn't even thought about this during the game, is that Corey Brewer played almost 30 minutes in this game, and I thought he's somebody who I usually pay attention to and, you know, follow him, but I didn't see him having a major impact out there when he was on the floor.
Yeah, he got a couple of those transition buckets that he'll get, but, I mean, Smith was 2 out of 6 on threes. Brewer only took 1 3, 3 out of 7 overall in the game. But, yeah, I mean, I think him not getting the three-pointers was a big part of Golden State kind of shutting down the three-point line. And, yeah, you know what? Like, Harden was hitting some really, really tough shots in the second half. You know, he got going on the back doors. He got a couple of real tough layups over Azili to close the third quarter. And then in the fourth, he was really on fire from mid-range on Thompson. And, you know, that's a shot that you live with if you're Golden State. And the reason is that, you know, he's not going to get fouled on those plays. So he's not going to get the efficient points there. And he's not going to pass to people for three-pointers either. And he's not getting to the rim. So, yeah, you know what? He's going to hit those, but it's still a better option to give up those plays and, you know, pat him on the back than saying, all right, you know, we're going to start double teaming more. And now we're going to start giving up three-pointers. A question I had for you. Prigioni only played 15 minutes in this game. Terry played 27. Would you have gone with more Prigioni? He was plus 10, granted against the bench units, comes in off the bench. But I thought he was very effective. Would you have played him more than that, or do you think that would have started to lead to diminishing returns?
I think they could have played him more. I thought he did a nice job, and he's somebody who has played plenty of minutes in his past, so it's not like he's somebody who can't scale up in that sense, and obviously he's on the, you know, he's on the backside of his career by a pretty decent margin, but I thought he played well. I would have played him a little bit more. I thought that Terry was exploited more than Prigioni was, and while Terry, I think, did a better job from what I could tell of, you know, hitting his shots and all that offensively, the defensive end is going to be very important for them. So I think if Prigioni plays as well as he did today, you give him a little bit more time.
I think so, too. I understand why they like Terry as a starter, because the ball is going to be in Harden's hands more often, and so you want to have Terry being able to shoot the ball to make the defense pay for doubling Harden, whereas Prigioni, he can hit a wide-open three, but that's not his default. He had a lot of success, actually, in pick-and-roll, especially when Lee was in there for Golden State in the end of that first quarter. But, yeah, I mean, I think I might try him a little more just because things ran so smoothly when he was out there, and you get a chance maybe to start a pick and roll with Prigioni and then move the ball to the other side with Harden, get the defense moving before Harden attacks instead of everyone kind of being set when they do that pick and roll. One thing I would say about Prigioni, though, he loves to do this thing, and a lot of point guards do this too, where he denies the ball inbounds, especially if it's Curry, you know, and they think that they're going to disrupt the Warriors' offense that way by having someone else bring it up the court. You can end that tactic if you're Golden State by simply throwing it into somebody else and then having Curry sprint down floor and get the ball on the move with Prigioni behind him. And then you're really, you know, Curry is in an advantage situation with this guy trailing behind him. And all of a sudden, like, you're not going to do that. But for whatever reason, you know, they just kind of give up and let the other guy bring it up the court. If you ever wanted to just end that tactic, you could do it, because Prigioni is just putting himself completely on the wrong side of Curry once the ball gets inbounded.
And you can do a lot with that. If a guy's behind Curry, you know, you can try to draw a foul on a jump shot, but also you're basically having a de facto fast break in that sense. I agree with you. I mean, I agreed with you when you said it. And I feel like there's a lot. I mean, the Warriors played a great second quarter in particular, but I kept on feeling throughout the game, except for during that stretch, that they can play so much better than they were playing in this game. And that's kind of incredible in a sense that, you know, they've done so well. And one of the really incredible stats that I think it was the Warriors stats crew put out, which is, to me, absolutely incredible, is that this was the sixth time in these playoffs that the Warriors have trailed by at least 13 points and won that game.
That's really just unbelievable. A crazy, crazy statistic. Also, this was, you know, there's that stat going around, the Warriors haven't lost. I think they're like 53-0 now when they lead by 15. And the Rockets had been like 42-1, 43-1 until tonight. And of course, you know, Golden State came back on them. So yeah, this is a team that really can come back. They up the defense to a frenetic level. Kerr goes to the break glass in case of emergency, line up with Green at center, and that lineup usually just kills people. The defense is just so good, and you know, this team is never out of it. You know, that's a cliche for a lot of people, but for the Warriors, it's really true. And I think, you know, I forget exactly what the stat was, but during the regular season when they trailed by 15 or more, which wasn't very often, they had some like unbelievable net rating during those minutes of like plus 20 or more or something like that. So they this is a team that gets back into the game quickly when they're down. Almost invariably.
I actually have that stat. So in the regular season, when the Warriors were down 16-20, so in that margin, their net rating was plus 20. And when they were behind by more than 20 points, which only happened four times, their net rating was plus 51.
Yeah. I guess they don't like being down more than 20 is the lesson there. A couple more thoughts, and then I have a couple questions for you too. Just little things here. Little coaching things from Kerr that I enjoyed. One was taking his time out in between two Jason Terry free throws. I think it was in the third quarter. And the reason you do that is because guys shoot a little better on second free throws than they do on first, which makes sense, right? If you go to the gym and you take two free throws, you kind of get the feel for it on the first one. And I think the last study I saw showed that players shoot, I think, about 2 percentage points better on second free throws than first free throws. That was a Sloan Conference paper years ago. And then, so that was one thing. You kind of take him out of rhythm. Maybe, you know, that's 2 percentage points worth of free throwing, but you know, maybe he misses the second one and it pays off. So that's one thing. The other thing he did, he knew normally Bogut would sit, you know, basically the middle part of the half and come back with 7 minutes left in the second half. He went to Bogut to start the fourth quarter knowing that he was going to go with Green as the closing lineup. So you might as well, like, use Bogut as the backup center instead of Azili or Lee and use his minutes then, because you don't have to worry about him getting tired. You weren't planning on playing him anyway. That was a good move also. Mm-hmm. So just two little coaching things from Kerr that I enjoyed in this game.
Is now the time that I should talk about how David Lee shouldn't get any more minutes, particularly at center, in the rest of this series?
And I could talk about the same with Barbosa. And,
oh, God.
And, you know, it's, and Kerr said he thought Barbosa played pretty well. I didn't necessarily feel that way. But to me, it's always like the Warriors have a defensive identity. That's what they are built on. They are better at defense than they are at offense. And those are the two guys who are really kind of one-way players that can be attacked, especially Lee, where it all kind of, went to hell with him out there, in the second half of that first quarter, and Kerr didn't go back to him in the second half. I think he at least noticed that it wasn't going to work for him. And then Barbosa, the same thing. I mean, you have, even though he wanted to give Clay a little bit more of a rest, I think he only played 32 minutes and tried to keep him out of foul trouble too at the end of the first half, even though he only had two fouls. He sat out the last couple of minutes of the first half, but there's plenty of minutes from Iguodala and Livingston and Barnes that could just be take up the Barbosa minutes instead, because Barbosa is just not a good enough defensive player when this is a team that can be totally impregnable. So why give him a weak link to go after?
Yeah, and even Justin Holiday in a few spot minutes, I'm sure he'd be pretty amped to be out there. And if you're basically saying just play defense, I'm sure he'd be pretty fine at that.
Yeah, I mean, but even then, you know, there's just a, you've got enough depth on the wing. You've got two great wing players in Livingston and Iguodala. You know, I mean, even Livingston, although he played a lot today, he was at, let's see, he only played
28 minutes.
Andre only played 23. Like, why not just have him out there for the extra 8 minutes that Barbosa was out there? He was 1 out of 5, only minus 2, but definitely got taken advantage of on defense a couple of times.
So I have a question for you. If if you're playing Draymond at center and assuming Steph and Clay are two, the other two, who are your other two? So let's say the three guys you're choosing between are Harrison Barnes, Andre Iguodala, and Sean Livingston. How do you balance those last two spots?
I think whoever's playing well, Barnes has been excellent, and his ability to attack the basket also even had like a couple of nice plays protecting the rim in that small lineup as well. I mean, the way he's been playing, I think he's got to be out there. He's the better shooter out of those two, and then you only fix it so there's one subpar shooter out there really with that lineup. So I would go with him, and then really whoever's playing better of Andre or Livingston. I thought in this game it was Livingston. Andre didn't have the greatest game in the world. But, you know, if you need kind of better help defense or someone who's a little bit stronger, can switch on to post players a little bit better, then you go with Andre. But it's not very clear. I think it's totally based on the feel of the game between those two guys to close it.
Yeah, and the other reason why Clay's defensive prowess is so important is that you don't need a man-to-man stopper out there. You know, that's granted, Andre is better now as a help defender than as a man-to-man defender, but it's so nice in that sense for the Warriors that they don't have to worry about, oh, well, we have to put Andre on James Harden, so he has to be out on the floor. You know, Clay can do that, and he's done a very good job. I mean, he was incredible on Conley in the last series, and so to be able to have a guy, I hate the two-way label and all that kind of stuff, but Clay, his value on the defensive end is very underappreciated, I would say, in general.
Yeah, I mean, he got lit up a little bit tonight. And I mean, he doesn't quite have that level of unbelievable athleticism where he's going to be able to contest Harden, step back maybe the way some other guys might. But the thing that he does do extremely well is he just stays solid, and he's just a really dogged defender, especially if he gets picked off on the pick and roll. He works great with Bogut when it's a 2-5 pick and roll for Houston, because Bogut can stay back and Clay will just doggedly pursue over the screen to get back in front of his man. When Harden isn't necessarily going to want to challenge Bogut, Clay will get back in front of Harden, let Bogut get back to the 5-man, and that's a really important aspect of the defense, even if Clay is not necessarily locking him down absolutely one-on-one in isolation situations.
Anything else? Or you said you had a few questions?
Well, I wanted to ask you this. Who do you think played better tonight, Harden or Steph?
Oh, I mean, I think Steph did, because he did a really nice job of kind of picking his spots. I thought Harden's fourth quarter was incredible, that he was making those shots. But I felt like Curry, you know, he had those moments, and he really did a nice job of, you know, when the kind of making sure, it's weird to say this, but the crowd was just huge in that second quarter and the noise and all that. And he actually was one of the few times, he doesn't usually do this, where he was even pumping up the crowd. I thought he tried hard on defense, and I thought they both played really well. But to me, if I had to pick which one of them played better, I'd say Curry.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Harden certainly had that one period where he looked totally unstoppable. And he had a great game, as we said, the 28 points, 11 rebounds, 9 assists, 4 steals. He also had the 5 turnovers, though, yep, which I think that would be the tiebreaker for me. I mean, people just don't look at the turnover column quite enough. Steph only had 1 turnover, and he had 34 points on 23 shooting possessions, which obviously is unbelievable efficiency. You know, basically almost a you know, pretty close, like 140 true shooting percent. Or sorry, no, that's not right. Never mind. I can't do math anymore.
Well, one thing I'd like to note with this that's kind of amazing is the Rockets bench had no turnovers as a unit, which is pretty amazing when you think about the idea of starters and backups. And granted, Prigioni is, from what I recall, is pretty good at taking care of the ball, but and it's not like they didn't play minutes. You know, those guys, they got their time, especially with Dwight Howard being limited. But I thought that was pretty impressive.
Yeah, that bench unit played well, obviously. I mean, that's the one that built that lead for them, basically, in the first half. You know, but I think that if the Warriors can just do a little bit better with that bench unit, maybe not play Barbosa and Lee as much, they probably win this game by 10, because that was kind of the big stretch when those two guys were out there that Houston took that lead.
Yeah, use Azealy, but make it so that when you're using a true center, it's Azealy or Bogut, not Lavely.
So there was one other thing that I noticed as well. A lot of people were killing McHale for not taking a timeout down the stretch of the first half when that run was going on. And, you know, I understand that point of view that you want to stop the run. But on the other hand, he still had two timeouts left at the end of the game, and that ended up being key. They actually could have potentially gotten a shot to tie it until, and, you know, they had 11 seconds left, I think, and they were down four. So that actually gave them a chance to advance the ball. They could have gotten a shot up, fouled, come back again, and maybe tied it, which if they had only had one timeout in that situation, they would have had no chance. It ended up being a moot point because Green knocked it away from Josh Smith on that last possession, and then, you know, they weren't able to get anything really. But, you know, I think that's why you save your timeouts. And, you know, if you're going to make a sub or whatever, you can do that. But timeouts to me are more useful to either advance the ball or retain possession, perhaps if like you're stuck on the ground or something, than it is actually to, you know, talk strategy and stop runs necessarily, because I don't think there's ever really been any proven statistical evidence that timeouts work to stop runs.
Especially when it doesn't look like they were going to make any subs, you know, and it wasn't like their players were more tired than the Warriors guys or anything like that, you know. It would have just been a way of trying to stem the tide, but I agree with you. I think that timeouts are better used in other circumstances.
Well, all right, let's move on to the other big news of the day, which was the Minnesota Timberwolves win the lottery in a massive NBA conspiracy against a big... Oh, wait, no, that's not true, actually. There are no NBA conspiracies. But the Lakers get second, Sixers third, Knicks fall to fourth in what their fans no doubt view as a huge calamity. You know, what are some of your general thoughts on how the lottery shakes out there?
I'm very excited for Minnesota. I like Wiggins a lot. I think he did more to kind of assuage my fears about his long-term potential. I thought he did a nice job this year. And either Towns or Okafor, though I'm advocating at this point for Karl Anthony Towns, I think either one of them would do very well for them. It's been kind of funny to me that in the early time of this, I've heard some people say, oh, the Lakers shouldn't take Jahlil Okafor because of... he doesn't fit with Kobe or he doesn't fit with Julius Randle. Right now, that second pick is the main building block for their future. It doesn't matter if he doesn't fit with those guys because he is more important to their future than that. That's why if you're not a good team, you take the best player available because you don't know how you're going to be building the rest of your team. So I'll go off of that. The other part of it that I was excited about in the sense is that, assuming they don't move the pick, Philly is presumably going to get their choice of the guards, and I'm excited to see what they do with that because I feel that they're a team that will heavily consider both. I think that Moutier and Russell and whoever else, you know, with Justice Winslow, Hezonja, whoever, they're all going to go there. So I'm pretty excited with how it turned out. And the Knicks pick, obviously their fans are disappointed. That becomes a gigantic wild card now because while I would support keeping the pick and they can get one of those top four or if they fall in love with someone else, it certainly appears, considering what their management is prone to doing, it seems like they're going to consider moving it, and that's a huge thing in this draft.
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, Phil Jackson, given his age, doesn't seem like the type to really want to start over. You've got Carmelo Anthony really potentially nearing, if not at, the end of his life as an NBA superstar at age 31. He's going to be coming off what seems like it's going to be a pretty severe knee surgery. And so maybe they do try and move that, use their free agent dollars. But part of the problem there, though, is if you move that pick, then whoever you get, if they're any good, is probably going to be making a lot of money. So your problem there, then, is you either have to get a team that will be willing to take some money from you, or you, in essence, use up your salary cap space and the draft pick in one shot to make that trade. So there's certainly a lot of things for the Knicks to consider. It is considered kind of a four-player first tier. Maybe some people would have Porzingis in that. Right now you've got Moutier and D'Angelo Russell,
as the guards, and then Okafor and Karl Anthony Towns as centers. And I don't have an opinion really quite yet on those guys. Hopefully I'm going to be able to dig into the film a lot more over this Memorial Day weekend, and we can podcast about those guys a little bit more as we get closer to the draft. But, you know, just based on what everyone else is saying, it's not necessarily a huge disaster because I think there's a lot of debate over who should, what the order of that top four should be.
Yeah. One thing I'll mention, you were talking about the Knicks and the possibly giving money back. One idea I thought of already is the idea of DeMarcus Cousins. I think that, first of all, I would just be amused with that. But what makes the Knicks really in a tough spot for that sense, and we talked about this a little bit with the Clippers yesterday, is they really only have two long-term contracts unless they're going to move one of their guys on a rookie deal like Tim Hardaway Jr., and that's Carmelo Anthony, who has a no-trade clause, and Jose Calderon, who is not expiring. He has two more years at around $7.5 million. One's a little bit below, one's a little bit above. And so if you're talking about, you know, trying to do the concept of, you know, like, you're not going to – that's a very different contract to try to give to somebody than somebody who's like, oh, they're on your books for a year and then they're gone, because some teams are looking at 2016 with dollars in their eyes. And so you're like, hey, you're going to have this money for a guy who's a backup point guard. That's hard to take for some teams.
Yeah, and that was one of the big downsides of that Tyson Chandler deal, was that they actually took on more long-term money as opposed to having Chandler, who expired this year. I mean, they did get off of Raymond Felton's contract. They also could use the stretch provision on Calderon as well, and not that I necessarily advocate that, but you know, if they're hoping to get something done in 2016, I mean, when you consider their idea that, all right, you know, we're going to have space this year, we can increase our space for next year as well by stretching him. And then, you know, the next couple of years, it won't really matter because we wouldn't have been in the free agent market anyway and below the cap. Maybe that's your thinking there. So that's another thing that they could consider. For those who don't know how the stretch provision works, by the way, it's basically releasing a player. But if you do it before September 1st, then you can stretch his remaining salary over double the number of years remaining on his contract plus one. So in the case of Calderon, he has 2 years left on his contract. So you would be able to stretch his salary over 5 years. Two times two is four, plus one is five. So that's what you'd be, how the stretch provision works. We'll talk about that a lot more as we get into free agency. But that's how that works. So last thing here, if there have been reports now, Flip is torn between Okafor and Towns in Minnesota. Flip Saunders, both the GM and coach. I'm a little concerned. I'm at least leaning so far that I think Towns is the better option than Okafor, both due to his athleticism and also something that we didn't see at all at Kentucky. The guy can really shoot the ball. When I saw him at the Hoop Summit practices, before even his even went to college, he was just draining NBA threes. In the practices, I think he's someone who could be able to, as a center, an athletic center, to do pick and pop from the 3-point line. I think that's a facet of his game that will not be explored at all by Flip Saunders, given his somewhat anti 3-point stance. So, you know, that could be one downside potentially of Towns going to Minnesota, because I think that's where a lot of his value could come in this new NBA.
Yeah, and that's definitely true. It would also be kind of interesting to see. Gorgui Dieng is a guy who I like. I don't love him, but as a guy who's kind of drifting between power forward and center, and his rim protection has been a little bit spottier than I hoped it would be, but him playing with Okafor and Towns, either way, I think would be pretty interesting to see, even though he's probably not going to be the other starter, just as a way to fit in a rotation.
Yeah, and you never want to draft if you got the number one pick, especially when you have, you know, a team that won as few games as the Timberwolves did this year. You want to just take the best guy. You know, you
absolutely
can't be worried about the fit. But that said, the fit of Okafor there, I don't think that Dieng is really a guy who can play power forward effectively. You know, he has an okay mid-range J, but not a really good enough for a power forward when you want to play with a post-up center like Okafor. And then you have Rubio, who can't really shoot much at the point guard. You've got a guy who's going to want to slash to the basket. Wiggins, who needs space to operate. Wiggins loves to get down in the post as well. So not a great, I mean, you can at least consider the fit with someone like Wiggins. And I think that Towns would fit much better with Wiggins than Okafor would. But again, I'm probably getting ahead of myself. I haven't even watched enough film on these guys. I'm just kind of going off what they're reputed to be able to do well and not actually how well they do it yet at this point.
Yeah, I definitely think that's fair. And I think that it's going to be a fun draft in the sense that from what I've seen so far, there are a lot of guys who have the capability of contributing. I don't think they're necessarily going to be a ton of, you know, MVP caliber guys in this draft, but there are a lot of like Mario Hezonja, Sam Decker, you know, guys like that who I think are going to be fun players in the league, who I think are going to be useful players in the league. And I always like that, you know, it's always good to add those 3 to 6 guys in rotation because they're exceedingly important. And we're seeing that in these playoffs, you know, those spots, while they might not be determinative in all the time, they're good teams need those guys. And especially if they can embrace that role.
Yeah. Well, it's, we got a lot of time to talk about the lottery. It's
going to be really
interesting to go through the team needs. I'm sure we'll do all that. It's actually pretty remarkable how chalk it was, ultimately, that I think the lowest team that moved, or the highest, yeah, sorry, the lowest team that moved up was the Lakers, right?
From four.
And they're the only team that moved up, right?
And only one team, from what I recall, only one team moved down, and that's the Knicks.
Yeah, so it was total chalk until then. The Heat kept their pick. They had a top 10 protected pick. There was a chance they could have gotten leapfrogged. But that didn't happen. And then, also the Lakers, of course, kept their pick. They were top 5 protected. So that now goes into next year, top 3 protected. I'm sure they expect to be a lot better next year and that won't be an issue either way. That they'll probably lose the pick, but they're probably hoping it'll be, you know, a lot lower than it was this year. The last thing actually, while we're talking, Daryl Morey, Rockets GM, had somewhat of an interesting tweet. Congrats to Warriors on game one win. Their top 5 guys played together so well, have been incredible in 800 plus minutes together in regular season and 150 plus playoff minutes. Interesting tweet from him because that's almost like, well, hey, we haven't had our top 5 guys together at all. You know, and now Howard is injured. I'm sure they're not feeling great about that. They're missing Beverly, obviously, a ton in this series, but it does put into stark relief just how healthy the Warriors have been in this year, how lucky they have been to be facing neither the Clippers nor Spurs, and to have both of them in the opposite bracket and play neither of them, you know, to have Kevin Love be injured. This is really, everything has gone right for the Warriors this year. You can't expect that to happen in another year. They really have to take advantage and convert this dream season into a championship, because this type of stuff, you know, you never know when it's going to happen again, and all the cards have fallen in their favor this year.
Yeah, I was talking with a member of the Warriors staff before the game, and what I said, and they didn't respond, was I said, this is your best shot. You know, this is the time, and they've been, I think the phrase to use is, it's been a charmed season for them. I mean, we've seen it so much, especially in the NBA this year, sadly enough, that even when a season can look like it's gonna have that direction. And, I mean, the other component of that even is the Hawks looking less like what the Hawks were that game when they outplayed the Warriors and beat them by, I think, 9 in Atlanta, is, you know, we're looking at a weaker Eastern Conference champion that will probably be the case next year, whether that be the Cavs beefing up their depth by using the tools that they have, and the Western Conference finalist will probably be stronger too, especially if Dwight Howard's hurt. I mean, that totally changes it too. So you never know. I mean, you can talk about the Oklahoma City Thunder making the finals, which the Warriors obviously have not yet done. And, you know, we thought they were going to make it back forever. So you always have to do it. But it's hard for me to imagine a circumstance where they get a better opportunity than this. So that doesn't guarantee anything. That doesn't guarantee them winning a single game, much less 7 more. But you have to take advantage of it when you get this kind of an opportunity.
Yeah, so we'll be watching the news really closely for what Dwight Howard's status is. If he's out or if he's limited, Houston is done in this series, which is really a shame to say, but I think there's no two ways about that. So hopefully he has a speedy recovery and we can have a few more games like this one, because it was a real good game to go to.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, all right, that'll wrap it up for tonight. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. subscribe on iTunes or at the Real GM page. Just search for Dunked On. Find it pretty easily, I hope. And we will talk to you next time after Game 1 of Cavs-Hawks. Till then.